From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. A court of claims judge has rejected the Trump campaign's request to stop vote tabulation in Michigan. We'll get the latest today from Rick Pluta. And we'll check in with reporters who covered the count in Michigan's two largest cities.
There was a lot of talk this year about Kent County as a swing county. So it's a county that went for Donald Trump in 2016, but then went for Gretchen Whitmer in 2018. And the big question this year was which way would it go?
Also, conversations with poll workers who were at the TCF Center yesterday as challengers yelled at them to stop their work counting votes.
You know, it's an intimidation tactic. It was scary.
Honestly, I was like, this is America, right? Like, this is where we are in 2020.
All that plus more news coming up today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, we'll check in with a couple of poll workers who were at the TCF Center yesterday in Detroit as GOP protesters banged on the windows and called for the vote count to be halted.
You know, it's an intimidation tactic, but I'm watching this crowd that is growing, and your mind can't help but wonder what would happen if DPD was not able to hold that door. It was scary.
That's later on in the program. But first, a court of claims judge has rejected President Donald Trump's request to stop vote tabulation in Michigan. Now, the count is largely done, but the results have not been officially recorded and certified by the Secretary of State. The Trump campaign's assertion was that GOP poll challengers were not granted, quoting here, meaningful access to observe polling places. Here to explain what all that means and what the judge said is Rick Pluta, Capitol Bureau Chief for Michigan's Public Radio Network. Hi, Rick.
Hi there. And I can tell you what the judge said. I'm not sure about being able to explain what it all means.
We'll do our best. So the Trump campaign did file this lawsuit to stop the ballot counting. What exactly was the campaign alleging?
Well, I think you explained it, is that they said that partisan challengers were not given access to polling places, and specifically the TCF Center in Detroit, and that they weren't able to get in close enough to do the things that poll challengers are supposed to do at these absentee ballot counting boards. And the judge basically called BS on all of it, that there were opportunities for people to do their jobs, and the fact that the Republican Party had not recruited enough poll challengers wasn't the responsibility of the state. And I think most significantly, Judge Cynthia Stevens, in her ruling from the bench, said essentially, in not so many words, I don't know what you want me to do, that the voting is done, the election is over, and you haven't presented me with a real workable remedy. And that's kind of where things stand, that she's writing up an order that should be issued by the end of today that would allow the Trump campaign to appeal this to a higher court if it chooses to do so. It needs that written ruling. Mm. And we will see what happens next.
Rick, I understand that the sort of key phrase in the complaint is meaningful access. Did the complaint or did the attorneys for the Trump campaign elaborate at all on what they meant by that phrase?
That question came up, and it's a murky phrase. It doesn't have any specific definition, but it seemed to me that the arguments were very abstruse at times, but it seems to me that it was a kind of a you know it when you see it sort of thing, and you know when you don't see it. One of the things that the Trump campaign also asked for was there are videos of absentee ballot drop-off locations, and they wanted the chance to examine those videos, but they wanted it in real time as opposed to after the fact when you could look at it and, you know, make some challenges based on that. They said that they wanted real-time access to those videos, and the judge was kind of in that same mode on, yeah, but what does that do for you right now? That's what it all came down to.
Rick, we saw reports that the claim from the campaign didn't exactly align with the claim in the affidavit that they were providing as evidence. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
I think, put succinctly, that the Trump campaign did not argue when the judge basically said in legal terms that this thing is kind of a sloppy mess, but I'm going to let this go forward so that we can get this settled.
Do you have any sense now of whether the Trump campaign will appeal this to a higher court?
No, although in fairness, I'm still in the process of putting together my work and I haven't reached out to the Trump campaign, although the last time I did on this issue, I never heard back. But it could, and it does seem, since in many respects, this is a moot question, that the voting is over, the counting is pretty much over, and the remedy that the Trump campaign says that it wants is no longer available. So the question is, why do they continue to argue this case? And it does seem, to me at least, to be that they're trying to run out the clock, try to do whatever they can to slow things down and maybe see if somewhere along the way that they do come up with something that would somehow change the trajectory on this race, now that it seems pretty certain that Michigan's 16 electoral votes are going to Joe Biden.
Right. I have a question about that. But before we wrap this up, this suit was filed in the Court of Claims for Michigan. What would be the next avenue of appeal if the Trump campaign chooses that?
It would be to take the case to the Michigan Court of Appeals. They could ask for a bypass to take it straight to the Michigan Supreme Court or go through the process. But, it would basically be those two courts to take it to the Michigan Supreme Court. One of the things that they did not try to do was to take this to the federal courts, which might be another option at some point, although I don't know that they would find that there's an active controversy. But the reason they went with the state courts is because they thought that they'd be able to get a decision faster.
So as you mentioned, Joe Biden has unofficially been declared the winner of Michigan's 16 electoral votes. So in a normal year, those electors would have to be decided how?
Well, the state parties, the Democrats and the Republicans, put together a slate. And when you actually go in and vote for one of the presidential candidates, you're actually voting for that slate of electors that on elector meeting day will show up and cast their ballot for the candidate of their party. And that's the final step in the process.
There's been some confusion about this, mostly at the hands of national political reporters who do not live in Michigan, who are now in the position of reporting on the horse race. Can you ever remember this process being played out any other way? Have the parties always decided the electors and who they're going to vote for?
Oh, yeah, that's the law, that they have to be. And then there is a day where the chamber of the Michigan Senate is turned over to the Electoral College, that the lieutenant governor presides over it, even though this year it's a Democrat, and they officially cast their ballots. It's a lot of pomp and circumstance. It's a big ceremony. And, the electors are honored to do it.
Rick, while I've got you on the line, there's been so much going on. I've got to catch up with you about the United States Senate race. Democratic incumbent Gary Peters appears to have bested Republican John James, although some news organizations haven't quite called it yet. The Associated Press did call the decision. Can you remind us which areas of Michigan appear to have made the difference in the vote for Gary Peters?
Really the same as in the presidential election. Obviously, elections in Michigan are won and lost in Southeast Michigan, but it was a close vote. It was a very close vote. And so I would say in every area of the state, because you had to turn out enough people to make up that margin in every area of the state, that if he had lost, or maybe when the Republicans are picking over the John James loss, I mean, they're going to look at where could we have turned out just a few more voters in Traverse City, in the Upper Peninsula, in order to make that difference. Because, marginal races mean that every vote from every part of the state matters.
John James, as of the time we're having this conversation, has not yet conceded to Gary Peters. Is there a path to victory for him at this point?
No, yeah. Just no.
You know, this is a candidate who got a lot of attention and raised an enormous amount of money for the race. And it's his second statewide loss. Do you think we'll see him again?
I do, just because he is considered by a lot of people in the Republican Party as sort of representative of the future of the Republican Party, that he's a veteran, he's a business person, that he's African-American, that he kind of represents, and he's conservative, and he kind of represents what a lot of Republican leaders think the party must become if it's going to be a viable political entity over the long term.
Yeah.
So we'll see him. Maybe not in an elected role. Maybe as state party chair. Maybe as a prominent spokesman. Or I've certainly seen this happen with candidates before, that he'll think that he had this moment to give it a try, and maybe it's time to move on to something else.
We have less than a minute left here, Rick. Turnout in Michigan this week exceeded the high water mark of 2008 with Barack Obama's first campaign. Were you surprised by that?
Yes. The Obama year was such a phenomenon with, people dancing in the streets in Detroit, that it seemed, at least at a visceral level, pretty difficult to top that. But, it's just a truth that Donald Trump is a turnout machine. And that is true for Republicans and conservatives who like his bombastic style. And it is also true for people who are just very, very put off by the loudness and the controversy that he brings to the scene.
Rick Pluta covers politics for Michigan's public radio stations. Thanks, Rick.
Oh, always a pleasure, April.
Coming up, we'll talk about how things went with the vote count in Grand Rapids and in Detroit yesterday.
There were some who were protesting against counting all of these ballots yesterday, specifically more conservative poll challengers and watchers and people who came to kind of support their conservative poll watching friends.
Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. The past 36 hours have been moving awfully fast. We'd like to take a moment to reflect on some of the counties that made the difference in marquee contests for the election. Michigan Radio's Dustin Dwyer joins us now from Grand Rapids. And Bryce Huffman is here, a former Michigan Radio reporter. He now works at Bridge Detroit, the nonprofit news source in the city. Dustin, Bryce, thank you for getting the band back together.
Hey, thanks for getting us together.
Thanks for having us here.
Let's start off with the West Side. Dustin, will you remind us how Kent County has voted in the past?
There was a lot of talk this year about Kent County as a swing county. So it's a county that went for Donald Trump in 2016, but then went for Gretchen Whitmer in 2018. And the big question this year was which way would it go? And it turned out that the Biden won Kent County by quite a lot, by a margin of about 20,000 votes.
We should say a word about how we got those results. There was a bit of a reporting delay, wasn't there? What was that all about?
It was really about the absentee votes in the city of Grand Rapids. It just took a long time to count them. It was more than 59,000 ballots, and there was no necessarily problem. It just took a long time to go over them. And one thing that took a lot of time was that there were challengers. There was a Democratic challenger and a Republican challenger, and any ballot that had any irregularity whatsoever, it had to be looked at. So there were a lot of ballots that just got, people spent a lot of time on those specific ballots.
Speaking of ballot challengers, Bryce Huffman, you've had quite a couple of days. First of all, could you tell us a little bit about what the mood in the city of Detroit has been like this week?
That's a big question. I think a lot of people are seeing kind of the high number of absentee ballots that were requested and were received, and they're hopeful because they see that this means that there is a pretty high voter turnout, relatively speaking. But there were some who were protesting against counting all of these ballots yesterday, specifically more conservative poll challengers and watchers and people who came to kind of support their conservative poll watching friends.
Yeah. Did you get any sense of whether those folks were City of Detroit residents?
Most of them that I talked to were not. Some of them maybe were born here or grew up here, but a lot of them had kind of more loose connections to the city. One woman I spoke to owned a little bit of property here. A couple of people say that they have friends who live here, but no, most of the people on the conservative side anyway, who were trying to stop the vote count, most of them were not Detroiters.
At the end of the day, this election for Michigan, like so many others, was deeply influenced by Detroit's votes. Bryce, can you help me out as the newcomer? How strong was Detroit's support for Joe Biden?
Well, when I look at the election results, and they're not completely finalized yet, still unofficial, but Detroit overwhelmingly supported Joe Biden. If you actually look at the results on the election website for Detroit, he got about 233,000 votes in Detroit, while Donald Trump and Mike Pence got a little over 12,000.
Dustin, just to go back to you, were you surprised that Joe Biden took Kent County? Like you said, this is a county that went for Donald Trump in 2016 and then went for Gretchen Whitmer, a Democrat, in 2018. So there's some back and forth. If you're looking at it in a broader political context, do you think the vote for Biden is characteristic to Kent County?
I wasn't surprised by it for a couple of reasons. One is we had that result in 2018 where Democrats did really well. The second is that there were just a lot of new voters, and this was true statewide, that a lot of people had registered to vote since the last time, and particularly in the city of Grand Rapids, those voters trend Democratic. The margins aren't quite as large as in the city of Detroit, but the city of Grand Rapids went 3-1 for Biden over Trump. So I knew that with a lot of new voters in the city of Grand Rapids, those would really tend toward the Democrats. But also you saw, Donald Trump, technically, he did win Kent County in 2016, but he underperformed previous Republicans by quite a lot. I mean, he didn't get as many votes in Kent County in 2016 as, for example, Mitt Romney did in 2012. So it was clear that Donald Trump was not a particularly popular Republican in this county. It wasn't a real Kent County Republican. So when we saw Biden come up and we saw all these other sort of demographic things, these new voters, I didn't really expect that Trump would win the county. I didn't quite expect that the margin would be that big, though, that Biden would win the county by 20,000 votes.
I want to talk to you about one of the other down-ballot races with another Republican who did very well. But first of all, speaking of the down-ballot, Bryce, let's talk about the U.S. Senate race. It seemed close for Democrat incumbent Gary Peters and Republican John James before the final votes from Metro Detroit came in. John James did not benefit. It sure looks like people who voted for Joe Biden also appeared to have voted for Gary Peters. Does that sound right to you?
Yeah, that is pretty right. But John James actually did get more votes in Detroit than Donald Trump and Mike Pence. So to me, at least, it would appear that there were some people who voted for John James, but still ended up voting for Joe Biden in the presidential race.
You know, I think John James is the first black man to run for Senate on either Republican or the Democratic ticket in Michigan. Why do you think that he didn't connect with Detroit voters?
John James, he really doesn't come off as a Detroiter to a lot of people from the city. His support of more conservative candidates and certainly his support of Donald Trump, it rubs Detroiters the wrong way. You have to remember, Donald Trump, someone who overwhelmingly lost the city of Detroit, clearly his policies, his attitude towards politics, it doesn't resonate with people here. It doesn't resonate with longtime Detroiters. So if you're someone running for Senate, based on your allegiance to a man who many Detroiters don't like, it's not surprising to me that a lot of Detroiters won't support you.
Yeah, I guess, you know, there were theories abounding all throughout the campaign about what, you know, what John James might have represented to today's Michigan Republican Party anyway. Was this someone who truly might attract more conservative black voters or somebody who might be seen as a vote of permission for some white voters who maybe wanted to feel like their party was more engaged in the black community, whether or not that was true?
Yeah, that's certainly something that I heard people talking about yesterday. I interviewed several people outside at the protest, and one of them who didn't want to go on record was talking about how they think that this election is a sign of racism in the Democratic Party by screwing John James out of a Senate seat. And whether or not that's true, there are people who believe that.
Dustin, let's go a little further down the ticket and talk about Peter Meyer. He won his congressional race in the 3rd District despite Democrats pouring some serious cash into it. Tell us a little bit about the election results in the 3rd for West Michigan. I mean, it's kind of interesting that we get this reasonably big vote for Joe Biden and then a vote for Peter Meyer. Can you break down what you think happened?
The 3rd Congressional District does include Kent County, which we've been talking about. And in Kent County, Peter Meyer didn't win. Hillary Scolton won the most votes. But the 3rd District includes many other counties. And in those counties, Peter Meyer ran up the score essentially enough to win the race. One interesting thing that I thought is that Calhoun County is one county in the 3rd District. Peter Meyer did win that county. But when you look at the vote totals for Trump and Biden and the vote totals for Hillary Scolton and Peter Meyer, Hillary Scolton actually outperformed the Biden campaign in Calhoun County, which suggests to me that there were people who voted for Donald Trump who also voted for Hillary Scolton for the Democrat for Congress. So there may still be some Trump Democrats in Calhoun County here in 2020. That was an interesting result that I saw.
It sounds like that kind of sets us up to see what happens in elections to come and which way those voters might go. I hate to say it, but in 2022.
Yep.
Dustin, there was a New York Times article from about a year ago that focused on Kent County as this example of changing demographics of suburbs. Would you say that outside of the Meyer-Scolton race, there was much of a breakdown in the city of Grand Rapids versus the surrounding suburbs?
Definitely. We saw, compared to 2016, Trump was losing margin in a lot of suburbs in Kent County. You saw Joe Biden actually flip the town of Rockford, which is in the suburbs of Grand Rapids. So throughout the suburbs in Kent County, you saw that Biden did better than Clinton in 2016. And you saw Trump was gaining votes, but because overall there were just more voters everywhere, but he was losing on the margin. So you do see definitely in the suburbs of Kent County, but also really in the city, a lot more voters just leaning toward Democrats.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking today with Dustin Dwyer, West Michigan reporter for Michigan Radio, and with Bryce Huffman. He's a reporter at Bridge Detroit, and they were both out and active covering the elections this week. Guys, there's something I wanted to ask both of you. There were many allegations flying around, not the least of them in Donald J. Trump's Twitter account, claiming misconduct in the election in Michigan. What did you see? Did you know we have the situation in Grand Rapids where results came in, you know, after taking some time to count, and we saw this influx of Trump supporters coming to the TCF Center in Detroit. Did either of you see any concrete evidence of misconduct?
I didn't see any concrete evidence of misconduct, but I did see a lot of people who were just very unfamiliar with Detroit's process and things that people who had worked Detroit elections before didn't find alarming. They found alarming because they were new to this system.
Bryce, could you give us an example?
Yes. So Detroit, being the largest municipality in the state, their counting process, it's massive, right? There are so many more voters here than there are anywhere else in the state that there were just so many more people and so many more moving parts that some of the election or the poll challengers who weren't from this area of the state were just confused by the sheer size of the operation going on. And that's something that some of the poll workers commented to me. You can tell some of these poll challengers are just brand new to Detroit.
What I saw in Grand Rapids, if I may, is that the Kent County GOP, they had challengers in the room as absentee ballots were being counted in Grand Rapids, but the Kent GOP had trained those challengers. Those challengers were prepared before Election Day to do that job, and it was a less acrimonious process. I mean, ballots got challenged, but people were getting along. We kept hearing from everyone in the room that it was a really sort of friendly process, even though sides may have been disagreeing, it really didn't boil over into any concerns. What happened in Detroit was kind of different because a lot of people showed up on election day, halfway through election day, who hadn't been trained, who seemed, as Bryce said, totally new to the process.
Bryce, the fact that there were so many people coming to the TCF Center, not just who may not live in the city of Detroit, but who were white people coming to this majority black city to challenge votes and literally chanting "Stop the count." That's problematic, isn't it?
You know, it was quite the visual because inside the TCF Center, I had noticed on election day how weird it looked to see mostly black Detroiters sitting at the table as poll workers doing their thing, only to see about 6 feet away a couple of middle-aged white women who looked like they had never been to Detroit criticizing the work that they're seeing these people do. So outside, to see basically the same thing, but amplified, was really interesting for me as a young black Detroiter who has been critical of our election process before and has been critical of City Clerk Janice Winfrey, but never would I ever dream of trying to stop the votes from happening.
There was a point at which the overflow of challengers, unofficial challengers, were trying to enter the work area. Did it feel at any point as though they would get in and stop the count?
No. To me, what I thought might happen was eventually, if the people who had been inside had calmed down and left, maybe they would start to let a couple people in who seemed to be calm. But there never was a moment where I thought the entire group of protesters would be able to storm the TCF Center and stop the count. I just never thought that was possible.
I wanted to ask both of you how unique you think this election is. This has been such a year between the pandemic and the economic slowdown that's happened subsequently and the massive protests around Black Lives Matter that have been in the streets in Detroit and also in Grand Rapids. And yet, it's funny, the presidential results don't seem to reflect a massive shift in public opinion when we consider the political histories of both these areas. What do you think? Dustin, do you want to go first?
Yeah, I mean, I think in Kent County, certainly in the city of Grand Rapids, these shifts have been happening all along. And I know Bryce has seen that. Bryce used to live here in Grand Rapids. And we saw massive demonstrations in the past several years around immigrant rights. We saw a lot more protesting in Grand Rapids long before the death of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor this year. That community was growing. Those organizers were getting more people engaged and involved. So to say that there would have been a massive shift at the ballot box, I mean, I don't think it would have been all of a sudden, because the work hasn't been all of a sudden. These people have been, you know, people have been working on that for years. And this campaign to get more people to the polls has been going on for years. And we saw these sort of results build from 2016 to 2018 to 2020.
Bryce, what about you? Do you think this is a unique year either in Detroit's life or in the life of West Michigan?
I certainly think there are some unique things about this election. One thing that we have to go back to is in 2018, when Proposal 3 passed, it made it easier for people to vote. It made it easier for people to register and vote the same day. It made it easier for people to vote absentee without needing to have some specific reason for voting absentee. So I think the idea that turnout was higher this year, people had been working for that. They had been working for that for years to happen. But what really made this unique, to me anyway, was that we're in the middle of a global pandemic. Back in March and April, Detroit was one of the hardest hit cities in America, and it potentially even one of the hardest hit cities in the world. But because of that pandemic and because of the coronavirus, this election was already going to be different. People were already trying to do more absentee and mail-in ballots. And I think that those ballots coming in late is really what made the difference in this election.
Just one more question. One of the other unique things about this year is that more people in Michigan cast a ballot for Joe Biden than have voted for any other candidate in the history of Michigan. Dustin, is that... was that a surprise to you, having covered a number of elections?
Well, in a certain sense, the population, you know, has grown, certainly out here in West Michigan. And, you know, every election, you hope that more people get engaged, that generally there are more people. So it's a record that I hope we set every election. But, yeah, I guess that is surprising that he would win by those margins. I think a lot of people saw Michigan as being a really close race. I mean, if the results that we're looking at now hold, it wasn't really that close of a race.
That's a great point to end it on. But Bryce, do you have thoughts on this?
I wish I could offer some thoughts that are better worded than what Dustin said.
I don't want to put you on the spot.
That situation's never happened. I'm keeping this recording. Sending it to my mom. Bryce said I said it well. Look, Mom.
He's arrived.
I think it's a little surprising when you view it just as that fact. But when you put it into the context of everything that's happened since the 2016 election, I think it makes a lot more sense that there was such strong support for Biden.
Bryce Huffman of Bridge Detroit and Michigan Radio's own Dustin Dwyer. Guys, thank you so much. Get some rest this week.
Thank you.
I'll try.
Take care, Bryce. Take care, April.
After the break, we'll hear from a couple of people who were working inside the TCF Center as protesters gathered outside and echoed Donald Trump's calls to stop the vote counting.
You know, it's an intimidation tactic, but I'm watching this crowd that is growing, and your mind can't help but wonder what would happen if DPD was not able to hold that door.
That's in just a moment. You're with Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. All across Michigan this week, folks were working overtime to make sure that an election could happen during a pandemic. It was a team effort in Detroit. The city clerk's office got some help from the Secretary of State, making sure that Michigan's biggest city could count ballots, including thousands and thousands of absentee votes, which have to be prepared for tabulation by hand. By now, you may have seen clips of the Republicans who came to challenge the tabulation process. We wanted to talk to some people who were on site. Detroiter Kalia Gaston works in urban planning. She says she's always been a political junkie, and she's been in Michigan for 20 years, but for a variety of reasons, this is the first year she's ever volunteered to play a role in the process. She was an election observer for the Democratic Party. Kalia, hi. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much.
So you start your day at 9:30 at the TCF Center. For those who don't really know the place we're talking about, could you explain what it was like in there?
So, you know, TCF is the new name. This is formerly Cobo Arena Hall, where we have the auto show normally in Detroit. So you're walking into basically a convention center, gigantic space that had been retrofitted to really house, you know, the election workers, the observers, the challengers. And so walking into the room, there was over 100 tables of people who were sitting there socially distanced from one another as much as they could be, wearing masks, actually processing the absentee ballots.
Folks may or may not know that election observers and election challengers were on site from both Democratic and Republican sides all throughout the day. Could you maybe tell us a little bit about what the mood was like early on in the day, just as things were getting started after training?
Yeah. And so there's, as you said, there's challengers and observers, Republicans, Democrats, but then there's also those who are independent or neutral from, you know, ACLU, NAACP, other organizations. And so as observers, you're there to observe the processing and counting process to make sure rules are followed. Challengers have other abilities to actually challenge votes, but no one is supposed to harass or to speak to election workers directly or to touch ballots. So people who are working by law are supposed to be free, right, from intimidation or harassment as they're doing their job. And that was not the tenor of what happened yesterday. So I got there at 9:30. By 11 a.m., it had started to be really tense, where people were being harassed physically. So although the legislature did not pass the law requiring social distancing, you know, you approaching the table is something that you can do. However, you have to ask. And that's not what was occurring. Election workers were literally doing their work with people over their shoulders, close enough to touch them, leaning in, using, in some cases, binoculars to observe what they were doing. People were being asked while they were working if they were Democrats or Republican, which is against the law. People were videotaping and taking pictures of those who were working, which again is a violation. So once I started to see those things, I was like, oh wow, like this is what I'm trained to observe and to document. And so there is a protocol for alerting the supervisor at the table of what's happening. We followed that process, but then sometimes we did have to escalate it because people would not step back, they wouldn't wear their mask in some instances. And so eventually, probably not until around 4 or 5 o'clock, did people actually start being removed. And I'm sure a lot of, people across the country saw, the doors that looked to be boarded up. They were not boarded up. There was cardboard up because, again, people were taking pictures, posting pictures of election workers on social media, which is a violation. And you could hear people banging on the windows and you could see the glass shaking. We also saw people climbing up on the windows, thinking as though they weren't being let in because people were trying to hide something. But actually, the room was full. So there were limits on the number of people who could be in the room due to coronavirus and also the need to keep everything balanced. So if you have 100 Democrats, you want 100 Republicans and 100 independents observing and challenging. When you see people behaving in that way and you've seen the things that have happened in Texas, with the Biden campaign being ran off the road, the stakes get heightened. And so we, banded together, people of all different races, ethnicities from all over the region to support one another. And there were a lot of tears shed, but I was very proud to be there as a volunteer. But I was proud of Detroit. I was proud of, the workers, many of them who are older, who sat for days, over a 2 or 3 day period to ensure that democracy would really work.
As all this was playing out, you're seeing the older poll workers who've been through this before. You're hearing the chants and banging coming from outside. And I understand there was also some chanting going on within the room too, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
What was going through your mind?
Honestly, I was like, this is America, right? Like, this is where we are in 2020. We talk a lot about other countries, about quote-unquote developing countries, about we've helped to ensure, right, elections in other parts of the world. And here we are in the United States of America, where the foundation of our country and democracy is being challenged. So when people were chanting, stop the vote, right, like that was a fever pitch moment where it's like, right, we claim that we want to, ensure democracy, but here we're saying, stop the vote, stop the vote, stop the counting. People inside were chanting, don't take my vote. And it's like, no one is taking your vote. You're here in Detroit, a city that you don't live in, challenging literally at some tables, every single vote, every single ballot people were challenging. Before ballots could even get to the table, challengers and observers in some instances were saying, I challenge all of the ballots, right? When you have our servicemen and women who risk their lives, and those were the last ballots to be counted, and those were the ballots that were being challenged the most. It's like, that's where it was last night. That was the reality. And that's where we are as a country. And so when we talk about democracy, when we talk about voting, right, like it occurred to me, I will do this every election. You have to defend the vote. Mm-hmm. And that's what a number of us learned last night. And people are committed that if we have to be in there 12, 15, 18, 26, 48 hours to defend our rights, especially as Black Americans, it's like, I don't want people to underestimate the racial component of this. You're talking about a city that's still almost 90% Black. You're talking about election workers that were at least 85% Black. And most of the GOP observers and challengers were majority white. And so you look at those optics of having white people harass, berate, physically intimidate Black people, the optics of that are chilling. And at that point for me, you know, a number of us cried.
Kalia, I was going to ask you why you stayed, but I think you answered that straight away.
You know, I also stayed for my daughters. I have a 9-year-old and a 2-year-old. And, you know, my 9-year-old, she wanted to be there. Yeah. And so I want them to live in a country. That lives up to the values that it proclaims. That's what I want for my girls. That's what I want for them. And yesterday was for them, for their mother to be on the front lines and to do something to help ensure that they get that opportunity. And I'll be out there again.
Thank you so much again for telling your story with us today.
No problem. Thank you.
That's Kalia Gaston, mother of two, urban planning consultant, and living in Detroit. You may recall we talked to Candace Fortman about her decision to go work at the polls. Fortman had a more official role in the process as a temp worker for the clerk's office. In her day job, she's the executive director of Outlier Media. Here's what she saw at TCF Center. Could you describe how many challengers you were working with?
Oh, there were quite a few challengers. And I would say that they really came in waves. So you would get a wave of Democratic challengers, and then you get a wave of GOP challengers, and maybe a wave of nonpartisan challengers coming in. But by and large, the largest group to come in sort of mass quantity at one time would be the GOP challengers. And, you know, you have to acknowledge the fact that most of the folks that were coming in as GOP challengers were white, and most of the poll workers who were counting absentee ballots were Black. And the optics of that was quite interesting to see.
Yeah. Something I think has been less discussed. You mentioned that there were also Democratic election challengers present. Do you have a sense of how many?
So I can say how many from yesterday, because we did a lot of counting yesterday. And so one of the counts I did, probably maybe around the afternoon, around 5 or 6 o'clock, we had somewhere around 220 odd GOP challengers in the room, and about 200 and maybe 7 Democratic challengers at that time, and maybe 75 nonpartisan challengers. The rules for the room stated that there should be 134 from each individual group. And so, of course, we had to end up balancing that out, which I think a lot of what you're seeing this morning, when you see, you know, challenger groups saying that they were not being allowed into the room, a lot of that was because there were already too many challengers in the room to begin with. And so the act of balancing out as people left and letting more people in to make sure that, one, we are abiding by fire code, but also it is critical to be reminded that we're in the middle of a pandemic. Making sure that there are not too many people in the room and that we're able to keep poll workers safe was job number one for us. And safety means not just making sure that they can do their job, but making sure that we were following the guidance of the Detroit Health Department.
How would you describe what the interactions were like with the challengers, both the Democratic and Republican and nonpartisan ones, all three varieties that were there?
Sure. Tuesday, we had maybe a few folks that were a little aggressive with our poll workers and were asked to leave the room by the Detroit Police Department. But that was a rare occurrence really on Tuesday. On Wednesday, when I went back, what I saw was an aggressive change in temperature and direct harassment of the poll workers. And that harassment really did come really connected to the folks that checked in as GOP challengers. And some folks, I believe, were checking in as nonpartisans, but were trying to sort of go around that rule of not letting too many people from any one party in. So they came in under nonpartisan because we could let more nonpartisan folks in. I think that happened on both sides, quite honestly, because getting credentialed was not exactly difficult, but it was more aggressive and just really hard to watch. We had to do more policing of the floor and making sure that poll workers were safe and that they were getting the space they needed to be able to do their job. And all of this is happening, of course, while we still have people in the hallway banging on the windows to the room and chanting things like "stop the count." But to their great credit, the poll workers did not, in fact, ever stop counting.
Did you ever feel at any point, we spoke with a reporter who was covering this, and I'll ask the same question I asked him. Was there ever a point at which you thought that the folks on the outside who were banging on the windows and trying to get in, was there ever a point when you thought they might get into the room?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know it's an intimidation tactic. And you tell your mind that, but I'm watching this crowd that is growing. I know what's happening on the outside of TCF at the same time. And your mind can't help but to wonder what would happen if DPD was not able to hold that door. It was scary for quite a while there, for sure.
Ultimately, the challenge crowd did dissipate outside. How long would you say it took that to happen?
Well, we had challengers there even when I left, and I left around 1 a.m. this morning. There were still challengers, and there were just a few. There were like a handful still there, but there were still people who were waiting to get in. And so the larger crowd, I mean, they were there the majority of the night. I mean, it might have started to wind down around 10 p.m., but the crowds, you know, were still there, and people were still checking in as challengers as late as 10 p.m. last night.
That's pretty late.
It's pretty late.
Did any of your experiences with all this change how you feel about the vote?
Oh, boy. What happened yesterday renewed my energy for protecting this thing that we call democracy. I think that so often it's a word we throw around and it's not actionable enough for us unless we're, you know, going to vote. It feels actionable on that day. But being able to work and being able to witness the incredible dedication of election workers. You know, yesterday they arrived at 5 a.m. Many of them did not leave that room until 4 a.m. this morning. They did not leave until every vote was counted. That is what democracy looks like. That is what civic dedication looks like. And I think what we have to focus on is how incredible it is that all of this turns because normal everyday residents step up to do the work. We have an elections office, but of course they could not pull it off without those folks who go to a training, who sign up for varying reasons, right? Like, we don't know why everybody is there, but we do know that they are there and they do their jobs. And it is why we are able to get our elections results with as little fuss as possible. And so I'm really grateful for our election workers. And I'm really, really hopeful that we have a renewed spirit for folks to sign up and to work on election day, because I think the more people we can get consistently doing the job who can then train the next generation of election workers, the stronger our departments will be.
Candace Fortman is the executive director of Outlier Media, and she was out there working the polls on election day. Candace, thank you so much for telling us about how it went.
No problem. It was a pleasure.
That's our show for today. I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening. We'll catch up with you tomorrow.